Town Hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest. We hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Gerald Walker. Gerald Walker is the author of Magically Black and Other Essays, published by Amistad. He's also professor of creative writing and African-American literature at Emerson College. How are you doing this morning, Gerald?
Good morning, Ethelbert. I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we have a lot to talk about.
Yes.
let's begin, Gerald, by talking about the essay form.
Sure.
What are the challenges that come with writing a good essay? What freedom and restrictions come with the essay form?
Well, that's a great question. I came to the essay relatively late in my writing career. I started as a fiction writer. My MFA is in fiction writing. And when I completed my MFA many, many years ago, I wrote fiction diligently with the hopes of having a national bestseller, as all writers do. And I didn't have a lot of success publishing my stories or the novels I wrote. And one day my wife said, well, why don't you try nonfiction? And I said, I can't do nonfiction. Nonfiction's for losers. Like I'm a fiction writer. I'm a rock star. But I thought I would try an essay just to kind of get her off my back. And so I wrote an essay, sent it out for publication, and it was accepted and later included in the Best American Essays. So I thought I'll do one more and that's it. I'm back to fiction. I did one more, same result just about. And so I kept having success with essays. And I realized that my creative impulses are more suited to the essay form. Hmm. In fiction, I simply had no, well, the world is yours to create as you would like. And I had no self-discipline to have my plots make sense. But with nonfiction, the boundaries are set. The facts are facts. The truth is truth. You can be creative, but within a certain parameter. Hmm. And so I am much more suited to write essays because I have to deal with the facts before me and I can't have my plots go off the rails.
I like how you said you were writing fiction first. I'm thinking of James Baldwin, and I'm going to ask you this question in terms of we're talking about essays, but you know when Baldwin got started, he was doing book reviews, and mm-hmm. I was wondering if you were also doing book reviews.
Well, I've done some, but I didn't start with that. That came after I began writing essays, so it was fiction writing for me first, and then essays, and then my essays brought me a certain amount of attention that I've been solicited to write book reviews. Mm-hmm. But my first love is still fiction, and I'm going to get back to it one day.
Okay.
I promise.
Well, let's go back to the fiction, okay? And you're talking about being a rock star. There must have been some fiction writers that you said, okay, I want to write as good as them, or I want to write better than them. Who were some of the models that you were looking at?
The people who really turned me on when I started looking at fiction writing were people like Raymond Carver, Dennis Johnson, Stuart Dybeck, my mentor, James Allen McPherson, Frank Conroy. These were the people who really got me excited about writing short stories. And I really wanted to have my name mentioned with theirs one day. And I just did. So that's probably as close as I'm going to get to being right in that company.
Well, you know, you just did something, Gerald, which I'm so happy that you just did this, because this is why I'm a literary activist. You mentioned James Allen McPherson.
Yeah.
You know, we could be talking about draft picks and not mention James Allen McPherson, you know, even though at one time, James Allen McPherson, you know, I think of his relationship with Ralph Ellison, he was one of the finest short story writers. Okay. But I always found that he was extremely quiet. And so I was just wondering, how was he as a mentor? Because he was a very quiet and shy guy.
He was a fantastic mentor because typically we were one-on-one.
Okay.
But workshops were kind of a disaster, and I don't mean to speak ill of my mentor, but I wrote an essay about my experiences with him in workshop. We would start class, and he would not say a word. So the students would talk, And we would talk and we would talk. And when we finished talking, he would say, okay, class is over. So we would go sometimes 2 hours and he wouldn't say a single word during class. And I was wondering, what is this? But it wasn't until I met him one-on-one that he really opened up as a mentor and friend.
Yeah, and he got one. I think McPherson got one of those early MacArthur grants.
I think one of the first. Yeah,
one of the first. Yeah, yeah. And when I think about that, and I think of McPherson, I also think of Ralph Ellison. And I was wondering, you didn't mention it. How much of an influence was Ellison on your writing?
Well, McPherson introduced me to Ellison. I had read his work as an undergrad, but as a work in a literature course with lots of other works. But McPherson really had me go and read everything Ellison wrote, especially his interviews. I have a fantastic book that I go to frequently now called Conversations with Ralph Ellison, just to be exposed to his creative and insightful thinking. Mm-hmm. And McPherson assured me that I would never have the breakthrough as a writer that I wanted until I had worked my way through the thoughts of Ellison. Mm-hmm. So I read everything I could get my hands on by Ellison, at the urging and insistence of James McPherson.
Hmm. So, we're going to talk about your collection of essays, Magically Black, but I'm going to focus on this fiction writing. When you started writing fiction, how did you handle theme, plot, character, dialogue? Were those anything that you felt were particularly, that you enjoyed doing, or you would say, okay, I've got to really improve on this?
I have always had a knack for storytelling. So I was, the craft of writing fiction was never really an issue for me. It was always the believability of the narratives I created. As I said before, I simply, I would have a mailman deliver mail, and rather than having him drop it in the box, I would wonder, well, what if there's a baby alligator in that mailbox? And then my stories would go off the rails. But I could always create dialogue and scenes, and I had no problems with those sorts of things. One thing that McPherson really helped me with, though, was having my narratives focus more on the depth and complexity of my characters, who were typically Black characters. And I was too busy writing very superficial stories, and they usually focused on hardship and pain and suffering that Blacks were going through. But McPherson really urged me to see the depth and breadth of the Black experience and to focus more on some of the positive attributes that have characterized our race.
You know, when you say that, that sounds like the difference between Jimmy Baldwin and Richard Wright. Yeah, you want to get into the depths of the characters.
Exactly. That is exactly right. And I think, I don't want to speak ill of another important figure in our literary tradition, but Richard Wright steered me wrong. I was raised, like many people, being exposed to Black literature for the first time, Native Son was kind of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I read that book and I thought, oh my God, I'm Bigger Thomas. I am that person. Mm-hmm. Until, again, McPherson had me take a look at that character to see that what Richard Wright had done was to kind of constrict his humanity in some very key ways, that he created a character who could not have envisioned Richard Wright himself. Mm-hmm. Because Richard Wright had the full breadth of humanity, but Bigger Thomas did not have it. And in some ways, that flawed character served as a model for many of my characters, who only wander through life upset, angry, believing they had no capacity whatsoever to overcome their circumstances. And that was the tradition I thought Black writers should write in. Mm. But I had
You said something very interesting there. You said, I'm a Black male writer, and I pick up as Native Son, And then I said, well, I'm a Black woman writer. Do I pick up Ann Petrie, The Street? Because The Street is the same time as like Native Son. But I'm saying in terms of, okay, if I want to be a woman writer, maybe that's the model I should go to. And I say that because it seems as if we have to wait for Gwendolyn Brooks to write Maud Martha. We have to wait for Zora Neale Hurston to write, The Eyes Watching God. If I'm a woman writer, the same way you say, okay, I'm a male writer, and Native Son speaks to me in this manner. I might disagree with it, as a writer and find my own style. But if you're a woman writer, where's your model?
Well, that was a really, really good point. And I think that was some of the criticism that people like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and others kind of leveled against the canon in the 70s and 80s. They said, where are our voices? And actually, where are our stories? Mm-hmm. And many of those stories, and thankfully, Alice Walker did a tremendous job in unearthing Zora Neale Hurston's work. to create the models for women writers and also for male writers. I mean, I learned as much from those books as probably any female writer on the planet. I mean, they helped me see that there was a kind of a false narrative being presented about the relationship between Black men and Black women. And those were important works.
I like how you said unearthing, you know, because I think of Alice Walker actually placing a tombstone, you know, on the grave site. So, you know, she was unearthed, but we got to make sure there's a monument so we can find the grave site. Okay, so that, but, you know, when we look at the reviews of Magically Black, Gerard Walker, there's often a mention in almost every review about your humor. And I wonder whether you use humor as a mask or as a tool to comment on say, racial matters.
I use it. I mean, it's an extension of how I use it in my life. In my life, I use it as a way of coping with upsetting things, things that anger me, things that piss me off, things that confuse me. I mean, one of the things that I experienced growing up on the south side of Chicago was that anger line in this story. It's something that would kind of release the buildup of frustration and anger. So I always tried to find some punchline and some experiences to help me get beyond it as a survival strategy. Mm. But it's a long tradition of, at least in the Black community, in the oral tradition, of blending tragedy and humor. And I try to work in that tradition.
Well, let's expand on that, because, you know, when we look at the oral tradition, you have the toasts, you have certain things, sayings that people grow up in their households, and it's tied in with folklore. You can trace that back as far as you want to go. But I'm looking at, how do you mine that? You know, I mean, I was influenced by Sterling Brown when I was at Howard University, and he was tapping into that. But I'm wondering, in terms of one, for those of us who are like, growing up in like Chicago, New York City, we're in the North. We're some like a couple of generations removed from that richness of that oral tradition. Sure. So I wonder, what do we draw upon? And is it distilled and has a different taste?
It does have a different taste, but I wouldn't say that we were so removed from it, because my mom came from Arkansas and she brought all of those traditions with her, and we were raised in those. And pretty much everybody, I mean, we were in the South Side, but we were basically the South. On the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So everybody I knew growing up as a kid played the dozens. We all talked about everybody's mother. We all ribbed each other about everything we could possibly rib. I mean, I think this was one of the flaws of the fiction I was writing. When I was writing those stories, and there was no instances of humor or irony in any of them. But when I think back on my life as a fact, I remember laughing a lot. Mm-hmm. I remember joking, I remember teasing, I remember having fun. And so that tradition of finding the punchline in a tragedy, I think is as rich as anything in the communities that are still considered Black communities.
Hmm. Let me ask you this question, just as building on this. You know, when we talk about, say, African-American writers, I say, oh, you know, I was influenced by Ellington, Miles, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And we talk about humor, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as you're growing up, and I look at myself, there are certain comedians that we're hearing, the same way we're hearing, oh, I grew up and so-and-so was playing Charlie Parker or John Coltrane. You know, it's like, okay, there's a difference between Richard Pryor and Chris Rock. There's a difference between Bill Cosby and Moms Mabley. You know, mm-hmm. When you're growing up, what comedians are you like listening to and laughing with that gives you a certain angle in terms of humor?
Well, Richard Pryor, certainly.
Yeah, you're a Richard Pryor guy.
Definitely a Richard Pryor guy. But I was also, and maybe you can't say this anymore, but I was also a Bill Cosby guy.
Okay. Well, you have to say it. It's important.
We have to say it. But yeah, my parents loved Bill Cosby. And this was back when you could get his humor on an album. So my parents would play the albums and we would just listen to Richard Pryor jokes. My parents were good, clean folks, so they preferred Cosby to Richard Pryor, but I transitioned because I was an inner city kid, so I had to leave Bill Cosby at some point to get over to Richard Pryor.
You know, when you say it, I remember, was it Pig Mouth, Pig Feet? There was a couple of comedians. Mom maybe was in the middle of that. that was sort of raunchy, that when you were growing up, your parents would, they were in another room listening to that, but you weren't supposed to be in the room with that, you know, because it was, you know, they were rated X, you yes. know, and I was wondering, was that the case in your household?
They were rated X, and but I don't recall listening to my parents during hearing.
And like Red Fox, for example, like Red Fox before he became like a TV person, the albums were not really, you know, clean albums.
Yeah, that stuff, that was underground stuff.
Right.
We couldn't listen to that. It's just like when Eddie Murphy came along and kind of included Richard Pryor. These were things that were kind of off limits in my household formally. But I know that my parents, if I said the name Red Fox, they would know who I was talking about.
Well, you know, in your essays, Gerald, you seem like your essays come out of observations and incidents that have occurred in your life. At what point might you cross into fiction to tell a story where the storytelling becomes a departure from your own experience?
I don't cross into fiction formally.
Yeah. Okay.
What I do is to use some devices that allow me to break the nonfiction rules. So, for instance, if there's a scene that I would like to write that I didn't personally experience, I will simply let the readers know I imagined it went something like this. And so by inserting a word like imagined, I'm kind of free then to slip into fictional elements, but not fiction per se. I always alert my readers to when I'm departing from the world of fact to the world of speculation. But I don't use fiction in my nonfiction.
Okay. You know, in Magically Black, you have like about 17 essays.
Yes.
The first one is actually the prologue, which you also call The Curse. And I find that seems to be a snippet from your other book, The World in Flames, A Black Boyhood and a White Supremacist Doomsday Cult. Am I correct in saying
you
that?
You are correct, yep.
Okay. You mentioned back in 1957, your parents were in a cult. So talk about Henry W. Armstrong and his Radio Church of God.
Yeah, my parents joined the Worldwide Church of God in 1957. Thereabouts, they were very young, in their 20s. And the Worldwide Church of God was a church founded by a man by the name of Herbert W. Armstrong. And some of the tenets of his religion were that whites had been created in the image of Jesus, who had been created in the image of God. And so therefore, whites were superior to all other races. And they believed also that the world would be ending in 1975. Mm-hmm. 3 years prior, in 1972, everyone who had been called to the faith would be taken to the place of safety, where we would hide out for 3 years until Christ returned. So those were some of the founding principles of the church. Now, I know what you're going to ask, so I'll save you time and I'll answer it.
No, I was going to ask you about how come you weren't believing Yakub and the big-headed scientists who created white people out of his thumb. That's what I was going to ask you, but okay. I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
Let me hear what you want to say.
Well, most people want to know, you know, how the hell did your black parents end up in a white supremacist doomsday cult? And that's a good question, and I've grappled with that for many, many years. But my parents were like many people who, when they encounter a person of tremendous charisma, you get kind of sucked into the narratives. You can believe almost anything. And with Armstrong being an expert on the Bible, he managed to find those narratives to try to convince all of his followers that what he was saying was from the Word of God. Mm-hmm. And he justified everything, including the fact that blacks were inferior to whites. There was also something else. Because both of my parents were blind, my dad lost his sight when he was 12 and my mom when she was 7.
Nine.
Right. Thanks for correcting
me. Just correcting you. Okay.
I was just testing you.
Okay.
You really read my work. Okay. Yeah, it was none. They were told, as everyone was told in the religion, that when Christ returned and the new kingdom on earth began, everyone who had a physical ailment would have it cured. Mm-hmm. And so my parents believed that when Christ returned in 1975, they would get to see their children for the first time. And that's a powerful incentive to pretty much believe anything.
You know, you say something in this prologue that you're talking about your parents. And I'll just read this one sentence because it leaped out at me. You write, when you have been identified by God as exceptional and are estranged from black traditions and culture, it is a small leap to conclude that you are not really black at all.
Yes.
That sentence seems to really run straight through all the things you're searching through in terms of the other essays.
Yeah, it's a quest for identity. I mean, we were raised in a church that had very specific practices that we could and could not participate in. So a lot of the cultural foods that Blacks ate at the time, chitlins, we couldn't eat that. You know, catfish, we couldn't eat that because it was considered to be unclean. So we couldn't eat a lot of the foods. We couldn't listen to a lot of the music. We couldn't do a lot of the things that Black folks did back then. And so when I finally left the church in my mid-teens, I had to figure out, well, okay, I'm not that anymore, but what am I now? And what does it mean to be a Black person? And I think one of the reasons, one of the ways that Blacks justified themselves as being members of the church was to believe that they were superior to other Blacks, that we were chosen to be with the superior white folks. So maybe we're not as high as them, but we're certainly higher than the Blacks who weren't called. And so when all of that stuff disappeared, when the church fell apart, the cult fell apart, those of us who had been raised on these beliefs had to figure out, well, what do I believe now? And if I'm not a member of this church, if I'm not going to be saved, if I'm not better than the other Blacks, what am I? And what does it even mean to be Black? And that's the question that has plagued me for the entirety of my life.
You know, when you mentioned this quest is for identity, I also look at when we deal with African-American literature, we have these themes. So my question to you, Gerald Walker, is this quest for identity, search for identity, have a parallel in terms of the sense of flight that we see happening in African-American literature?
Flight as in?
As going from the South to the North, or flight trying to get back to Africa.
Right. Well, it is, in a way, in fact, it does parallel it, because I have been trying to, it's kind of white flight in reverse. Maybe it's a Black flight from whiteness to Blackness. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to figure out since I was 15 or 16 years old, trying to figure out how do I get back to the thing that was my original identity before this church kind of robbed me of it? Like what does it mean to be a member of the Black community? And what does it mean to practice Black traditions and Black culture? I've been trying to figure that out. I mean, I've learned some things along the way, but trying to get my way back to the roots of my origin and culture has always been a quest of mine.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, let me ask you something. It's sort of like how we talk about, I would call deep tissue massage. I'm gonna go back. I asked you some questions, but I'm gonna go a little further. Sure. And this is, if I was reading and analyzing how you were talking about your parents, I would say, okay, the fact that at an early age they were blind might say, okay, this is why they joined a cult, that there was some sort of veil or some sort of thing, or the fact that they're listening to radio, right, or the fact that because they're blind, you know, there's a certain disability, that you say, okay, I have to have a faith in something.
Yes, but I also think that if my parents had not been blind, they still would have joined it. I think they simply believed in the message of what this man was preaching.
Okay, and let's talk about, okay, so yeah, we know what they're learning, right? Okay, what are they teaching you? I mean, I know, for example, when I was growing up, there would be kids, they were the Jehovah's Witness kids, right? And they seemed like they didn't have any fun, you know what I mean? You know, so maybe this whole sense of you being attracted to humor is because maybe you didn't have any fun when you were growing up.
I'm trying to catch up.
Right, exactly.
There was very little fun in a doomsday cult household, let me tell you that. No, we didn't have a lot of fun. I mean, my dad had an amazing sense of humor, so we joked and we kidded a lot. But most of my youth was plagued by fear and terror. I mean, when we went to religious services, it wasn't to be uplifted. It was to be scared shitless. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting through those 2-hour sermons with the minister saying, "And if you stray from the word of God, you will perish in the lake of fire for the next." I mean, that's a terrifying thing for a 7, 8, mm-hmm, 9-year-old kid to hear. Mm-hmm. So when you sneak into the kitchen one night to steal that last cookie, mm-hmm, you think by morning you're going to be...
You are the last cookie.
That's it. That's it. I mean, you're taking your life into your own hands for every little transgression that all kids make. Mm-hmm. But we lived in a constant state of fear being raised in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you have in your essay, and this is seems where we are as in 2024, Your essays also seem to be a commentary on Trump and his MAGA followers. You're like, you know, what would you say, okay, coming through a cult, what would you caution other Americans to look for? I mean, what happens in a cult?
Well, I tell people often that I sincerely believe that Donald Trump is Herbert W. Armstrong reincarnated. Like, this is the same guy, but these guys come and go all the time, these cult leaders. They tell you that the world is a mess, but that only they are equipped to fix it. They tell you that they are flawless because God has created them specifically that way. And Trump is always saying that he's a perfect guy. He's got the perfect hair and he's got the perfect everything. And they make promises that they can't deliver on, but they always find an escape hatch for those promises. I'm going to do this, I'm going to deliver that. And when those things don't come to pass, they say, that's because you didn't do something right. And our cult leader would often say, for instance, in 1972, when the Great Tribulation did not begin, he would say, it was supposed to begin, but God said, you are not ready yet. You haven't done the things you're supposed to do, including sending me more tithes. I need more checks from all of you in order to get this thing done. And Donald Trump constantly does the same thing. He's always saying, in order for me to make this country great again, I need you to send me more money so I can enact these policies and these whatever. It's just a con game that's repeated over and over again.
So if we look at Trump and his followers, and we look at your parents and who you love, what is missing in their life? Why are they following, you know, Trump? Why are they following Armstrong? Why do they need it? And then how do they get out of the cult?
Well, I think they need it because something in their life is missing and making them think, I've tried everything. I've tried to work hard. I've been honest. I've tried to live my life a certain way, and I still can't get ahead. And this person is promising me something that I, to this point, haven't been able to achieve. And so in some sense, there's a, what do I have to lose by giving this a shot? And they do it. But you can't, you get out of a cult when the prophecies fail. I mean, when Armstrong's cult fell apart in 1980. But it was because he kept making these promises that things would happen and then they wouldn't happen. And you forgive those failures a few times. But as they accumulate, you begin to think, this person might be a false prophet.
But does America have to be turned into Jonestown for people to wake up and say, okay, I shouldn't have had the Kool-Aid and the grilled cheese sandwich?
We're going to have to get close. I think we're going to have to get close. I think we're going to have to, Trump is going to have to be so awful as people predicted he would be the first time. And he came close. He was pretty awful then, but he's going to have to be a lot worse than that before his followers finally reject him.
Let me ask you this question before we take a little break on Gerald Walker. It seems it's like what we just happened just a few minutes ago. If you're a writer now and you're writing your stories, how do you shield your narrative from what I would call like a Trump virus? Like, it seems like, oh, yeah, we'd be talking about something and, you know, I'm watching the football game, somebody scores a touchdown, now they do a little Trump dance. So that, you know, so, I mean, it seems, okay, I'm writing my story, and why does Trump have to come into my narrative?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I sure as hell didn't want him in mine. I mean, in my previous book, I made no reference to him whatsoever. And that came out in 2020, right when at the, you know, peak of Trump, I didn't mention him. And the only reason why I mentioned him this time was because the parallels between Trump and the founder of my cult were just so striking that I simply couldn't ignore it. And I also wanted to put a little bit of context into who I am as a person, that I fell into a belief that in order for me to have the pride in myself, I had to believe a lie of a white supremacist. And I see so many Blacks who are being duped the same way, that they're separating themselves from the masses of other Blacks by aligning themselves with the white supremacists. And I just felt I have to.
So let's take, for example, I'm your editor, and I've been working with you. I helped you get your other books published. But now I get this new manuscript, mm-hmm. and I say to you, Gerald Walker, I like what was happening, but then you got off on this Donald Trump thing. You know, like, why can't you just tell me the story straight? You know, no condiments. You know, just tell the story. Why does it have to be this, to a point where, if I'm picking up this book, your novel or essays, 15, 20, 30 years from now, it sort of like seems dated. Like if, for example, if I wrote a poem back and I make a reference to Nixon, you know, well, Nixon could, you could say Nixon is a metaphor. I think right. The question would be, at what point does Trump become a metaphor?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, just writers have to make choices. I am, in my previous book, I deliberately stayed away from those current events and political events because I was aiming for a sort of timelessness, that these are mm-hmm. stories that can be read at any point in the future. And you don't have to know much about the time in which they were written in order for the stories to be effective. Right. But with this story, I really wanted to, and at my editor's urging, I wanted to put my finger on the pulse of what's happening right now. So in some ways, I suspect the essays might become dated, or they might become a way for people 30, 40, 50 years from now, if the book is still in print, God willing, to say, I want to know what that period was like. I want to get a real sense of what that period was like.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break, Gerald Walker. I would say the fact that you say God willing shows that you might still be in a cult, but I won't go there.
Well, I put it in quotation. You didn't see my quotation marks.
Okay, my guest this morning is Gerald Walker. He's the author of Magically Black and other essays, and he's also a professor of creative writing and African-American literature at Emerson College. My name's E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a town hall meeting on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon to 2:30 p.m. Plenty of off-street parking is available. As this will be our last town hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Gerald Walker. Gerald, one essay that stands out in this collection, Magically Black and Other Essays, is your essay called Lost. Before I ask you to read an excerpt from that essay, talk about what are your concerns, what have been your concerns as a Black father?
There are many of them, but, and I try not to do this because I realize that it's not healthy, but I live in a constant state of simmering fear and concern for my sons. One just left now to head to work. And I worry about what might happen to him, just some random encounter with some idiot racist and some things go awry. And I also wonder, because my sons, I raised my sons very differently from the way that I was raised. I mean, I started off in the cult with very little Black culture. Then I went to the South Side of Chicago and I was steeped in Black culture and inner city life. And so my teenage years living in an inner city and as a delinquent myself kind of prepared me for dealing with all of what has followed since I left that community. Like I have no concerns about leaving my house in dealing with whatever crackpot comes my way. I've been prepared for that. But I worry in removing my sons from the inner city and from those types of community where people are toughened, if they are prepared to deal with some of the things that they might have to deal with. So it's a constant battle, I think, for Black parents. What do you do you don't want to expose your kids to things that they shouldn't be exposed to and kind of rob them of their youth, but you also don't want them to be so naive that every little thing is almost too much for them and overwhelming. So I worry that I haven't prepared them for dealing with hardships, but I also am grateful that they haven't had to deal with certain hardships. Mm-hmm.
Gerald Walker, read an excerpt from the essay Loss, because, you know, I saw something that I wanted you to share with our listeners. It's on page 41.
Page 41. This is just to put it in some context, my son, Adrian, was at his high school theater practice. He was supposed to be home 3 hours prior. I'm freaking out. My wife is slightly concerned, but I'm very concerned. And when he finally arrives, this is what he says when he walks into the door. "I got lost," Adrian said. "I teleported to the liquor cabinet. As I removed a mug and a bottle of scotch, I casually asked over my shoulder, 'You didn't by chance stop at someone's house to ask for directions, did you?' 'Well, I was about to,' he said, 'but then I figured how to get to Main Street.' We lived on Main Street. It spanned our entire town. In a visit there in 1942, Eleanor Roosevelt declared it the most beautiful street in America, primarily because its wide expanse was lined with massive elms, and behind many of those massive elms were multi-million dollar estates, and behind many of those multi-million dollar estates, I had glimpsed now and then, were horses. Most of the homes on our end of Main Street were considerably more modest in size, price, and pets, but they were by no means inexpensive. And their occupants, perhaps even more so than the multi-million dollar estate occupants, upon being roused from sleep by a black person at the door, would have been petrified, possibly hostile, and maybe even, like Theodore Paul Wafer, moved to commit murder. The black person Theodore Paul Wafer murdered was a 19-year-old named Renisha McBride. A year earlier, in 2013, McBride crashed her car while traveling through Dearborn Heights, Michigan, a small town that was 85% white, 10% less white than where we lived. Her car was totaled, but she was uninjured enough to walk in search of assistance. At around 4:30 a.m., she knocked on Wafer's door. Wafer, after opening it and seeing a lone girl looking discombobulated and, I imagine, relieved, raised his shotgun and unloaded it in her face. He feared she was a burglar, he later claimed, which did not deter the authorities from charging him with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and possession of a firearm during the commission of a crime. He was convicted on all counts. Charged with manslaughter but not convicted was Randall Carrick, the Charlotte, North Carolina police officer who just a few months prior to McBride's death killed a black man named Jonathan Farrell. Like McBride, Farrell had crashed his car in the night, and he too had gone on foot searching for assistance, stopping for it at a random house not far from his immobilized vehicle. The lethal weapon this homeowner wielded was not a shotgun, but a phone. She used it to call 911, reporting a burglary in progress at her residence. Soon afterward, Officer Carrick arrived on the scene, whereupon he shot Farrell 12 times, a bullet for every 2 years of his life.
You're listening to Gerald Walker reading from his book, Magically Black and Other Essays. Gerald, my question to you is, okay, Adrian gets home. How many days, weeks, or even years did you write the essay?
After that event,
yeah.
A decade. I wrote this just a couple of years ago, and this happened back in 2012, 13.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's very interesting in terms of, I know you're teaching, but I'm going to get into some of the things of your approach to methodology in the classroom. It seems right there, advice to writers, there may be things that are like seeds that happen to you. You may not write about 2 years later. Okay. But then the question is, how do you find your voice to write those things?
Well, I often let incidents kind of just marinate over the years before I tackle them. I kind of want them to solidify into a very specific thing before I take it on. If I write about something that happened very, very recently, I often don't really have a handle on it yet. Mm-hmm. I need something to kind of plague me for a long time. And then I toss it over in my brain over and over again from different angles. One, to try to understand it, but two, as a matter of craft, to see how I might approach telling the story. Mm-hmm. Putting a story on paper, though, is not to say that you haven't been crafting it long before that. Mm-hmm. So I think about stories for a long time before I commit them to paper So by the time I turn my computer on, I kind of have a draft already fully formed. I just have to really nail it down on the page.
Okay. You are a twin, if I'm correct.
That is true. Right.
You also have an older brother, Tim. Mm-hmm. Right. Looking at this, your experiences, I'm thinking of John Edgar Wideman, where there's a difference between him and his brother. And someone could say that's had a lot to do with the times. And I'm just wondering, when you look at what you've written, how life is your life different from your twin, and how much is your life different from your older brother?
My life is probably couldn't be more different than my twin brother's life. We both made decisions in our teens to commit ourselves to a life of crime and delinquency. we were, you know, 17, 18 years old, and we said, okay,
you little rascals, you.
I wish that it was as simple as that, as innocent as that. But we decided we're going to be gangsters. And so we're going to make our way through this world at the expense of other people. And I did that for as far as I could take it.
What was the wardrobe? What were you wearing? You and your brother wanted to be gangsters. What do you have, like fedora hats or something like that?
I definitely wore a fedora. Are you kidding me? I had seven fedoras. I mean, I had a fedora for every day of the week. So we dressed like the people we saw around us, like the pimps and players who were walking along 79th Street in the south of Chicago. We modeled ourselves after them. And but the problem is that modeling often led to the same places where they ended up, which was in prison or in a grave. And when I was
wait, let's go back. Gerald, I mean, you don't have to confess on the ear, but did you have a jerry curl back then?
Oh yeah, I had a jerry.
All right. No further question. Go on. Continue.
And the only thing I regret about it is that I don't have any photos of it, because I would like my kids don't believe it when I show them pictures. But yeah, I had a jerry curl. So we had that lifestyle, and we were unified in that lifestyle. My older brother Tim as well, he was in fact our mentor when it came to street life. He was teaching us how to live in the underworld, so to speak. But when I was about in my early 20s, a friend of mine contacted me to buy some coke from him. I was heavily into cocaine at that time. I didn't have any money. He said he would give it to me on credit. And so I went to the dope house where he worked at. Back then, they were rent apartments, and for the sole purpose of selling drugs out of. So he worked in this apartment. You'd go and you'd buy the drugs. And I was going to his dope house one night. And when I went into the alley to go up the back stairs, and someone emerged from the shadows and put a gun to my head. And he robbed me. The joke was on him, though, because I was there to get coke on credit. I had no money. And so he checked my pockets. I didn't have anything, and I was about to leave. And he said, no, go where you were headed. So I went up to the third floor, knocked on the door. My friend Greg answered. I said, hey, I was just robbed. And we both laughed about it, because that was, you know, a pretty common occurrence back then. If you survived it, then you could make a joke out of it. And so I got the dope, went back downstairs, thought the guy would rob me. He wasn't there. And I went home. 30 minutes later, my brother Tim called to say that my friend Greg was dead, that he had been shot 6 times. At the very spot where the guy put a gun to my head and didn't shoot me. And that was the night where I had to make a decision about the direction my life would go. I had used half the coke. I threw out the other half. And I decided from that point forward that the street life was not for me. So I left that community. I stopped speaking to my twin brother, my brother Tim. I stopped speaking to everybody in that neighborhood and started to take a different path. My two brothers stayed in that community, however. My twin brother is still there now, struggling as people do. And my brother Tim actually died when he was 47 years old of a drug-induced heart attack.
You know, when you say, I'm thinking of Billy Bathgate, Doctorow's character, where he says in the beginning, it was juggling that got me here. It's sort of like chance type of thing that affects our lives. Mm-hmm. Gerald Walker, after that, I wanted to ask you, you write as a member, maybe this gets back to the choice you made. You write as a member now of, like I would say, the Black middle class, and it seems you are often walking a tightrope in your essays, balancing race as you try to balance yourself. Would I be correct in saying that?
That is exactly right. Yeah.
And what are the challenges of that as in terms of issues of now race and class?
Well, the great secret that people don't seem to recognize in America is that class is often much more of a determining fact of someone's life than race. Navigating class is extremely, extremely difficult. I think I've figured race out. Like I can maneuver the races, and I can manipulate them, and I can take advantage of them, and I can use them to my benefit. But class is something else, and it's a tricky thing to find yourself living a lifestyle that is so completely different from the one that you grew up in. That is difficult for me. It's still difficult to navigate. I live in this great million-dollar house, and I drive a fancy car, and yet I still somehow can't get comfortable with it in a way that if I had been raised with a certain amount of wealth, would have been easier for me. Like my wife wasn't wealthy, but she was raised in a middle class to upper middle class community. So she's comfortable wherever she is. I'm still uptight in these communities, and I'm still uptight sometimes when I meet people who are from a certain class. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Let's talk about before we end our program. I want to take you into the classroom. You've been teaching creative writing, and I wonder, what do you want your students to learn from you in a classroom or a workshop?
To be honest, I mean, when I like the beating heart of creative nonfiction and essays is being honest on the page. And one of the reasons why I really didn't want to switch to nonfiction was because of a lot of the stories I've told you here. I didn't want to expose myself for having lived a certain kind of lifestyle. I didn't want people to see that I had engaged in some petty criminal behavior, that I had done things that I'm not proud of. And so I hid behind my life with fictional characters. And so when my wife was urging me to try nonfiction, one of the reasons why I gave that I didn't want to was I would expose myself. People would see me for who I am. And what she helped me realize was that there's nothing special about me. Like, who do you think you are that your faults will somehow separate you from humanity? Your faults and your mistakes are what unite you to humanity. So whereas I was worried that people would see me as something separate from them, by saying I have made these mistakes, I have these character flaws, I've had these difficulties, that they would see a certain kinship with me, because we all suffer from these failures in some way.
But you know, when we look at the genre of poetry, you know, we have so many writers, you know, who use a persona, who are writing about themselves, but they use a mask. And this gets back to what I was saying earlier about humor being a mask. And I wonder, in terms of one, if you're talking to young writers, you say, okay, you have to expose yourself if you're going to be a great writer. Okay. But then the other thing comes in terms of how many writers actually lie, which is as part of the storytelling.
It is part of the storytelling. And that's reason. I think that's the reason why some go to fiction, choose fiction over nonfiction, that they want to have free reign of the lie. The people who write nonfiction have to understand that the truth, even if it is damning in some ways, is still worth being a member of the literary community in a way that. Again, you connect to the rest of humanity by showing your flaws as well as your attributes. I mean, you do both. And so when I tell my students to be honest on the page, and it's not that I want them to just tell all. I mean, I don't teach students to write confessionals. There are many stories that I could tell that I'll never tell, because I'm not gonna get into that kind of honesty. And I tell my students also, you don't have to tell every story. Yeah. Like if there's something that makes you uncomfortable or you don't want to reveal it, you don't have to reveal it. You have to be comfortable with the stories you tell. But if you decide to tell a story, you have to commit to it, and you have to be honest on the page.
What writers do you mention, and we mentioned earlier in our show, James Allen McPherson. What writers do you think we should be teaching more in the classroom? You know, like I think about how I could look at a number of people's syllabus and no one's teaching, like, say, Clarence Major. You know, I could go down to William Melvin Kelly, you know, some of the writers from the Chicago Renaissance, for example.
I think we need to be teaching Arna Bontemps more, Don Oliver Killens. We should be still teaching. But probably I would put at the top of my list is Albert Murray. When McPherson was mentoring me and teaching me to kind of have a certain literary perspective, he introduced me to Albert Murray. I'd never even heard of him. And I wondered how could I have gone through my entire academic career and not heard of this man who
you sound like Wynton Marcellus.
But I mean, it was so refreshing to read someone who helped me understand right. my place in the world as a Black person. And when I was trying to move from writing these pessimistic, kind of angry, defeatist narratives, it was Albert Murray who flipped that whole narrative on me. I mean, he talked a lot about antagonistic cooperation, mm-hmm. whereas there can be no matador without the bull. Mm-hmm. And so if you like the way the matador dresses and he moves and he has the style and he does all these cool things, well, he can't perfect that craft unless he's got some raging animal in pursuit of him.
See, I'm glad you mentioned Albert Murray, because I worked in the African-American Research Center at Howard for 40 years. Those Albert Murray books didn't move off the shelf. I had a problem with Albert Murray when I was reading them letters between him and Ralph Ellison. And I said, yeah. These are two elitist guys, you know, who feel that, you know, and I felt they wanted to be these intellectuals, you know, that for out of Oklahoma, you know, you say your roots in Arkansas. And I said, there's some of that I just can't, for being from the South Bronx, I sniff at that and I say, that's a cult.
Well, they would have done well in the Worldwide Church of God, I think.
Exactly. And get everybody else who's listening to Charlie Parker or something like a bebop, they don't, you know, they like Benny Goodman guys. You know? but I want to, and we got to move to the end of the show. And you sort of hinted at this, but I think it's very important. When I read your book, what do you want your readers to come away with after reading Magically Black? Is there any way, for example, this is a collection of essays, would you say, oh, if you pick this book up, read this essay first, even though you have a prologue?
No. Well, it's funny you say that. The essay that I would like people to read first and that I wish that I'd started with is an essay called It's Hard Out Here for a Memoirist. And it's an essay about me thinking that I was a pimp, or believing that I was a pimp. And it talks about the ways that, you know, Black lives are influenced by various cultural practices. But if there are three things I want people to take away from the book, it's probably just an expanded definition of what it means to be Black, and to see the variety of ways that Black identities are shaped and formed, and probably and to have a heightened appreciation for the heroism and resiliency that have always characterized the Black race.
Mm-hmm. Well, this last question, Gerald Walker, is one I think I was reading some information about Baldwin, and Baldwin was talking about how, right, he had like Ray Charles. I was wondering about if you were able to translate your words into notes, what musician or singer would you hope to sound like? That sounds like an Oprah Winfrey question.
It does kind of sound like it, but it would have to be George Clinton or Bootsy Collins.
Oh, come on now. No wonder you had a Jerry Curl.
I mean, it's got to be. I'm a P-Funk kid. I mean, that's just when I that those are my people.
Okay, so I sign up for your creative writing class, and you come in, you tell me that, and then you say something like, and I think you should read a little James Joyce.
A little James Joyce and a little P-Funk, and you'll be all set.
Well, you know, I'm having this conversation with you, Joe, and I'm always asking these writers about music and stuff. And many times we think about African-American literature. But what about painting? How much are you influenced by visual arts?
Not as much as I should be, especially mm-hmm. considering my wife is an art historian. No, they don't factor into my creative process very much at all, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, so now being perfectly honest, and I like how you answer this question, and it has a lot to do with what you were saying earlier in the show. You mentioned how your wife told you what you should be doing. So I think you should have another conversation, maybe over a candlelight dinner, so that you'll get more into the visual arts.
I will.
Okay. All right. That's my homework, and that's for our next interview, Joe. That's what we will talk about, all right?
I'll be ready. I'll be ready for you.
Okay. My guest today has been, I really enjoyed this conversation. My guest today has been Gerald Walker. He's the author of Magically Black and Other Essays, published by Amstead. and he's also the professor of creative writing and African American literature at Emerson College. The show's On the Margin. My name's Yes Burt Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3.
Election Day 1992, throngs of mostly black voters gathered in Detroit City Hall to applaud the installation of the first Democrat in the White House in 12 years. When the applause died down, one black politician said presciently, "It really don't matter. The president can be Democrat or Republican, white or black. The Dow Jones can go up or down 500 points, and black folks still gonna be poor." Thursdays at 2 p.m. beginning November 14th, Short Money Dissecting Racial Capitalism with host John Jeter explores the intransigence of black poverty and how the dispossession of the African-American community affects the nation's bottom line. That's Thursdays, 2 p.m., Short Money Dissecting Racial Capitalism with host John Jeter on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a town hall meeting on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon to 2:30 p.m. Plenty of off-street parking is available. As this will be our last town hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
This is what WPFW sounds like without volunteers. This is what WPFW sounds like with volunteers. Help WPFW avoid the sound of static and continue the mission of building a better world, one broadcast at a time, by becoming a phone volunteer today. Information and registration at 202-588-0999, extension 1008, or via email at volunteers@wpfw.org. Just say you want to volunteer and leave your name, phone number, and email address. It's that easy. Again, that's 202-588-0999, extension 1008, or volunteers@wpfw.org. Phone volunteering is a critical part of supporting WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Dispelling disinformation, checking the facts, speeches to the spoken word, Marley to Basie, Etta to DMX, En Vogue to Chick, Malcolm to AOC. Jazz and Justice Radio is doing its part, but we need your voice. WPFW is asking for your opinion as part of its 2024 Community Needs Assessment. More info at WPFWFM.org. It's your opportunity to contribute ideas and speak your piece. We're back! WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to social justice calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events.